Hello, I am Mayor Watt. That is Ometown.com. I'm getting right into the news. It's been a, well, let's just say a horrible week. I'm going to do the show really quick. Probably won't be able to linger afterward as much as I would love to. But I'm going to do these articles and then get out of here. I'll be back tomorrow in a much better situation and we'll go from there. But I've already selected about 15 or so articles. No waiting. Let's get going. The first article is over in the Four Wheel Tech channel, which I don't really highlight all that much. There isn't that much news that comes out of it. I aggregate from a few sources, but they're not particularly busy, and there isn't necessarily that much information as of yet. I'm looking for more sources because I want to kind of start talking more about the four-wheel tech, which is about technology in vehicles, right? So I've got a couple of them. This first article is Volkswagen has a new US-made ID4, starts at 38,000. I'm going to round up with a small battery. And it says, last year, ours visited Volkswagen's factory in Chattanooga, Tennessee, where the company was preparing to begin local production of its ID4 electric crossover. The factory is now up to speed, and VW is making good on its promise to make a cheaper ID4. I don't think they're called ID4s, but ID4s. Anyway, I'm going to click the link, take us over to Ars Technica. Jonathan M. Gitlin is the author of this. For some reason, I really like VWs. I really like their electric bus to come out, but it seems like it's not hitting the road anytime soon. And so I've got a pre-order in for a Canoe, which is similar in spirit, but far away from actuality in comparison to the VW. It's much like the VW bus, but you know, quite a ways away from it. At any rate, if you're watching the stream, then you're looking at a picture of the ID4. Chattanooga is now assembling the EV crossovers with 62 kilowatt hour or 82 kilowatt hour packs. So it comes to somewhere around 201 horsepower, and you can either get it in the 82 or 62 kilowatt hour pack. I'm not quite sure what that's going to translate to in range, though, because it my problem with estimated ranges is that the environment plays a massive role in it, from my understanding. I don't have an electric vehicle. I want one, but I do not have one. I need to do something real quick here. Living the dream, folks. Living the dream. Pardon me. Okay. Well, anyway, it says that cuts the EV's price by $5,000 to the ID4 Pro. So the ID4 standard starts at $37,495. I round up to $38,000. And then you get a $7,500 federal tax credit here in the U.S. I don't know about other countries, other regions, but the standard makes do with EPA range estimate of 208 miles, which is just horrible compared to gas cars. Until we get the gas range, I don't think that it's ready for prime time. Early adopters and ultra early adopters, this current time frame is early adopter space. It just doesn't rise to the level where people in conventional cars can feel secure in going the distance, so to speak, because I know that I can get 400 miles if I cruise control my way on the freeway. One direction, 400 miles, without stopping, 400 miles. But this is half that range, which means I'm going to have to stop somewhere and sit around, and hopefully there is a supercharger floating around. I just don't see it happening. Smaller pack is also available, ID4S trim, which starts at $42,495 before tax credits. And features more standard equipment like powered seats, a panoramic roof, LED lights. But it says, however, it doesn't appear to be an option to get a smaller battery pack with all-wheel drive twin motor powertrain. Yeah, because you're going to get 50 miles out of it. It's all horrible. Anyway, this will not hit it out of the park for me. So let's go on to the next thing, which is the opposite side of the spectrum in terms of performance, I'd say. Formula E will close out its season this weekend with its first ever visit to Seoul, South Korea. It's not just the end of the season 8 and the last race for the Gen 2 electric race cars, but also marks the series' 100th race. I have a hard time saying series. Anyway, the sport has come a long way since its first E-Prix, right? Grand Prix. I always like saying pricks. Anyway, in Beijing in 2014, 8 years ago, with more powerful cars, bigger batteries, and an ability to put on an exciting race at Monaco, something that Formula One hasn't been able to say for several decades. Ouch, meow. Let's go over to the source of this meow. And that's Jonathan M. Gitlin hitting this out of the park, apparently. After 8 years, 100 races, and nearly 1,000 points, Lucas Degrassi knows his stuff. So Formula E's most successful racer shares his ideas on racing technology. What do you think of that? Yeah, I won't go through it all. But you know, if somebody's been racing these around for a while, I can't get into car racing all that much. I appreciate what it does. A lot of it goes from tactical to practical, just like the Militaria kind of thing goes from tactical to practical. The FIA have a championship that can develop and it can use some of that expertise to cross over to different series, but they don't overlap. And at the moment, there's a lot of overlaps between endurance racing, Formula One, Formula E. It's that the regulations are not very clear. So there's a lot of observation from the perspective of doing it quite often. And it says here, for Gen 4, the answer isn't just add more power. We're arriving with a problem that with Gen 3, because now we have so much power that if you can give the Gen 3 cars another 100 kilowatts or 135 horsepower, on the rear axle for attack mode, it makes almost no difference in lap time. The car cannot get that power down. We have so much power in Gen 3 that it does not matter much if you're going to have 50 kilowatts or 67 horsepower more or less in attack mode, because you're going to be almost traction limited the whole time. Yeah, so you can't actually put the power to the road because your tires light up and you get all squirrely. That's when it's to the rear tires, I suppose, right? But why not make it so that everything is all, and that's the next line. So four-wheel drive for me. There you go. All the manufacturers are already producing high-end cars that are four-wheel drive electric. Perfect. So this should lead to optimization in the commercial sense, and all electric cars should be able to be all-wheel drive. And instead of I still think that the weakest link in this whole thing is that consumers have to buy their battery. And that battery is a consumable, just like gasoline is. And I think that, I don't know, maybe a billionaire out there can see through all of the BS and say, let's sell electric cars where the battery is nothing more than a swap in, swap out at a gas station. And you employ some people at each of these gas stations to make sure that you don't have some numbnuts that just drives over the thing incorrectly and the battery gets misaligned and blah, blah, blah. Just like oil changes, you have somebody that actually does the oil change. Well, in this case, you have somebody that does the battery swap and you charge, you know, I don't know, $10 for a battery swap, but it takes 5 minutes and you can go through hundreds of these a day, you know, just as much as gasoline, except that nobody has to pay the $25,000 price for the battery. And because it stays within the network, bad batteries that are getting tested and fail can go back in and be reprocessed. And then at least you can say that you're being a little more green, and instead of what happens with batteries is they die. Somebody has to spend $12,000 to $25,000 to replace the battery. But now, because you're not spending $12,000 to $25,000 for a battery pack that's going to die at some point, well before the lifetime of the vehicle, I mean, unless you are driving it into the ground, now you spend the money on making sure that all of the cars are all-wheel drive all the time, and the battery isn't part of the price. So instead of a $50,000 car, it's a $30,000 car. Then you've got people that are going to be buying these cars more, because they won't have to worry about the battery pack failing, and they can just drive over to the battery swap station, swap out the battery, park it in their garage again, just like a gas station. Get it done, folks. So at least I'm on the same page as Degrassi's idea about all-wheel drive electric car should be standard. It's apparently going to be that way in Formula E, and that will translate into optimized performance at the consumer level eventually. Let's move on to the next article. I don't have any music playing. It's just me in this office. Not even blinky lights back there. Man. Falling apart. So in a sign of what might be good news, I didn't believe it when I first saw it, but apparently it's true. This is in the Stock Marketeers channel. That's where it was aggregated to from MarketWatch. McDonald's is set to reopen in some cities in Ukraine. McDonald's will reopen some restaurants in Kyiv and Lviv. I guess it's Lviv. Kiev or Lviv. Am I pronouncing that right? Man, I wish I had somebody that was an expert in the linguistics to tell me how I'm mispronouncing that. Let's click the link. It's not that big of an article. James Rogers is the author of this article over at MarketWatch. And it says, basically, McDonald's is set to reopen. That is actually some pretty spectacular news. Just the other day, I heard that Crimea is getting Crimea'd, and people are bailing from there you fired at us and we're going to take this back kind of situation. Not sure what's going to happen over there, but I think it's pushing further to the east side of Ukraine, and maybe Crimea will be taken back and they'll just kind of shove the invaders out. And then maybe they can clean up, you know, the hot mess that was Donbas and figure out what to do with this this fringe element that was funded by Russia. But good luck. I think McDonald's staying in Ukraine and bowing out of Russia, and then everybody watching as the Russian chain that took over starts making excuses about quality control and stuff like that, was kind of interesting to see. But it says McDonald's has continued to pay its more than 10,000 employees in the country, according to the Associated Press. You know what? I'll go buy some McDonald's simply because of that. Still supporting these people while they're in a fix, which is spectacular. Let's move on to the next article. The next article is in the Lonnard section. Mixed messages from the ABA as it reaffirms rule against non-lawyer ownership while also encouraging innovation. I don't really take the stance that this article is over at lawnext.com, and I'm going to see if I can find who the author is. Bob Ambrogi. So this is the first time I've aggregated anything from lawnext.com, but they're talking about how if you are a non-lawyer, you are not allowed to own a law firm or even be in a partnership with an attorney. So for instance, I can partner with an attorney, but they can't act as an attorney. they can't represent themselves as an attorney, and it can't be a law firm. I can't own anything in a law firm as a non-lawyer. It's a messy situation, and it's all about separating the business aspect from the lawyer aspect and a conflict of interest and da-da-da. But essentially, you have to be an attorney to be in a partnership or own a law firm. So it says here, as states seek to find innovative ways to address the access to justice crisis, a key component has been eliminating or loosening the prohibition on non-lawyer ownership of law firms. 2 years ago, Arizona became the first state to completely eliminate the prohibition. Just 2 weeks earlier, Utah had approved sweeping changes in legal service regulation that allowed non-traditional legal services providers. And other states continue to study the issue. In the face of these regulatory reforms, the ABA, the American Bar Association, voted today at its annual meeting to send a decidedly mixed message, approving a resolution to double down on its prohibition of non-lawyer ownership, while also amending the resolution to add a nod towards state innovation efforts. But I don't really have a problem. I mean, I have a problem with the fact that for me to have any partial ownership of a law firm, I have to be an attorney. I have a problem with that. But the message really is you need to be innovative, but it doesn't necessarily mean, well, open it all up and let anybody become a partner. I think that there could be issues with non-lawyers being part of a law firm because non-lawyers may or may not follow the same rules and land the firm in hot water because the partners may or may not, again, may or may not have the same legal filter in place. And so they may say or do something that compromises the integrity of either a litigation that's in process or the integrity of the firm because some information was exposed and conflicts of interest aren't necessarily addressed in a professional manner. And I said way back, I had an issue with a very major manufacturer where they exposed my address, my physical address, because I was lighting them up regarding the quality of the product that I was receiving. And somehow I ended up as a point of contact on a public facing website, and a person showed up at my doorstep at 11 PM, asking for a solution to a problem that I had nothing to do with. And I'm to this day astonished. Well, anyway, I could never find a law firm that had the provenance that allowed me to believe that they could represent me against this juggernaut of a company. I mean, it's a massive company. Everybody knows who they are, but I won't say anything about it anymore. Well, when a law firm does their due diligence, they have to look for a conflict of interest. And lo and behold, every law firm I contacted said, sorry, we've represented them at some point, and therefore we cannot represent you. Ta-da. So anyway, it's one of those things where you end up screaming into the void in frustration because you know that there's nothing that you can do. And I didn't know of an attorney that really was kind of like, you know, had the internal fortitude to represent me and at a cost where I knew it wouldn't just drag out. But at any rate, and that might be why the ABA really doesn't want non-attorney professionals working with attorneys. It says here, as presented to the ABA House of Delegates this week, Resolution 402 reaffirmed a 22-year-old resolution that said that the ownership by non-lawyers is inconsistent with the core values of the legal profession, and the prior resolution said The sharing of legal fees with non-lawyers and ownership or control of the practice of law by non-lawyers are inconsistent with the core values of the legal profession. The law governing lawyers that prohibits lawyers from sharing legal fees with non-lawyers and from directly or indirectly transferring to non-lawyer ownership or control over entities practicing law should not be revised. Well, it doesn't really matter. That right there is just kind of self-referencing resolution. It's kind of talking within itself and not giving a real reason why. So it just says it's the affirmation of these core principles and values is important now, particularly at a time when external forces threaten the profession to lessen its commitment to the public and to the professional independence. That too doesn't mean much. If you want to read more about it, follow the link. It'll take you through Ohmtown over to that article. Let's keep on hustling through these articles. The next one is about Gmail. And I, many, many moons ago, we're looking at close to 20 years ago now. Oh gosh, I'm hinting at how old I am. Attention Gmail users. Your inboxes are about to get way more spammy with political email thanks to a new ruling by federal regulators. I'm feeling something in one of my mailboxes, not from Gmail, though. It's actually from my ISP, where they must have turned off a filter or something because I'm getting all kinds of garbage, an overwhelming amount of garbage, to the point where I'm thinking of starting refiring a business that I had 20 years ago that stopped spam from ever even leaving the spammer's servers. If I didn't accept it, if I didn't want it, it would never leave the sending server. Beautiful piece of work. Everybody who used it loved it. Nobody wanted to pay for it. Unfortunately, it doesn't exist right now. And I'm afraid actually to go and verify that nothing like this exists, because I feel like the moment that I say something out loud, it actually is made manifest in the universe, becomes a reality. And well, then I can't say that it's my baby out there. Anyway, Google asked federal regulators to okay a plan for easing spam filters on political emails. I don't want political emails. I do my own due diligence, and I don't sit there and I don't want spam. I don't want unwanted political emails. I don't want any unwanted emails. So maybe I will refire my anti-spam server. I'll have to talk to a couple of people and see if I can make it happen. It takes some custom code. I probably don't even have the historical archive anymore, because it would be so out of date now that it would probably be a security issue. So get ready for a whole lot more political spam in your Gmail box. Dave Leventhal is the author of this article over at businessinsider.com. And Federal Election Commission voted 4-1-1. So 4-4, I guess, 4 pro, 1 con, 1 abstained to approve Google's plan to unleash the hounds of political hell upon you. Hundreds of people wrote the FEC to lobby against Google's plan. Well, you know what? Google's going to make money out of it, folks. What are you talking about? That's what it's all about. You don't become a billionaire by turning down other people's money. Let's move on to the next article. Gas prices are falling. Here's why it's happening and whether it can continue. Well, I don't think it's because of me, but I did say it out loud. And like I just got done saying, if I say something out loud, then it's made manifest by the universe. And boom, it doesn't work when I'm asking for winning lottery numbers, but apparently, when I start complaining about high gas prices and saying that we're going to move towards $7 and mortgage rates are going to keep on going until we're at 11%, suddenly everything starts falling falling. So the national average of gas dropped below $4 here in the States. The national average for a gallon of gas dropped below $4 on Thursday for the first time since March. Is more relief coming? So let's click this link. It takes us over to CNBC, and Pippa Stevens is the author of this article. And I will never learn. The streak of daily declines in the retail price of gasoline is about to end, said Andy Lippo, president of Lippo Oil Associates. Well, you know how that works? That's because people are greedy. And when it doesn't serve them to keep prices, I don't know, profitable, you have record freaking profits, folks. Raising the price is just predatory. Gas prices are below $4, and yet you're still going to have record profits. It's really kind of scummy. It drives me nuts. It really does. In the commodity market, there's a common saying that the cure for high prices is high prices, and that's proved true. In other words, high prices bring down demand, which brings down prices. Well, that's actually pausing demand. It doesn't stop demand. It pauses it. People don't go as often to fill up their tank because it's so high, but it's not actually stopping demand. It's just putting the brakes on it, which is kind of ironic, right? Because it's cars. Anyway, so people fill up and then they wait longer before filling up again. But price elasticity of demand means that you could have kept on raising the price, and you would have more and more record profits. Why? Because people have to get to their jobs. And unfortunately, now that the pandemic is waning and we're looking at monkeypox as if it's going to be the next incoming thing, and really COVID is just kind of endemic, you're going to end up with people being forced to show up for work in the physical sense, even though it's more efficient and highly effective to do everything online. You don't have to be in person to get your job done if you are in a white collar sector. If you have to do boots on the ground, construction, or other blue collar work, as it's known, then yeah. If you have to do customized bespoke products where you have to touch it and it's only in one place, then yeah, you're going to have to show up. But many, many people shouldn't have to show up to an office just to show the boss that you are in the office. Pardon me one second. See, again, I had to cough every episode. Anyway. And with states suspending their tax, that is the biggest impactor on the price. Because now the states are kicking their tax, but the profits are still going to the business. So now you're going to have crappier roads. Education is going to get screwed over in these states. Oversight is going to be rebudgeted. Let's just say people are going to be invited not to return and things like that. Basically, taxes pay for services and maintenance and oversight and everybody's really happy not to pay taxes. But guess what? It supports society, and we are all part of a society. If you're not part of it, what are you complaining about? Nobody wants to take anything away from you, but if you want to use the roads, you have to pay the taxes. If you want an educated population, you have to pay the taxes. If you want safe buildings, you have to pay the taxes because there is oversight. If you want police, fire, sewer, all kinds of other stuff, you have to pay the taxes because you're part of society. You're being protected by the infrastructure that exists, the military that exists, the United States that exists. You have to pay the taxes. Support your country. Pay your taxes. and it's much more cost effective. A lot of people sit there, oh, $5,000 hammer. There's a lot of context to this that's missing. And there's complete ignorance of what federal contracting entails, which is why I have a channel that's referred to as FAR Weekly. And I periodically talk about it. But it's state taxes that are a bigger burden on prices, but it's to the benefit of the local people. Federal taxes were only 19 cents or something like that, but state taxes are somewhere around 50 to 60 cents per gallon. And the rest of it is profit, not profit, but it's cost going to the gas companies. Let's go on to the next article. Happy to talk more about that too. The next article is in The Word in Tech, and it's about Anchor. Yes, I'm a big fan of Anchor. I don't have anything to do with Anchor. I just really like Anchor products. I like their quality. I like their quality control. I like their capabilities. Anchor launched a new $150, I'm rounding up, portable PowerCore 24K GAN. So it's a GAN charger. Housing a big 24,000 milliamp hour battery for you to carry around, which is capable of being it's capable of fast charging at 140 watts. Your MacBook Pro. Anchor's new 24,000 milliamp hour portable battery can fast charge a 16-inch MacBook Pro. That's amazing. And it doubles as a hammer. Just kidding. It doesn't. Don't hit anything with a battery pack. The PowerCore 24K has power delivery 3.1 for fast charging itself and other devices at up to 140 watts. This is an article over at The Verge by Umar Shakir. And it's $150 available now, apparently. It can pump more than the previous maximum of 100 watts from a single USB-C. That's PD 3.1 spec. Bumping it up to 140 watts. And there's also one USB-A port capable of 18-watt charging. So that's for that old tech. Come on. Let's see. What else does it say in here? Other chargers that Anchor just released aren't capable of PD 3.1, including the new Anchor 747 GaN Prime, which is capable of 150 watts of charging. However, each single port can still only output 100 watts max. Yeah, I'll probably end up getting this. I'm actually looking for bigger battery, so I can forever keep my iPad Pro charged. Oh, my upgrade is actually waiting downstairs, waiting for me to do the big switch from my old iPad Pro to the M1 iPad Pro. Anyway, there you go. That's that one. I got a few more articles. The next one is in the Hatch Ideas channel. Walgreens is reportedly offering $75,000 signing bonus if you are a pharmacist because they are struggling. Well, let me tell you, I've run into some people at the Walgreens pharmacy. I probably shouldn't say anything. Walgreens is offering as much as $75,000 in sign-on bonuses for pharmacists. The bonus comes amid an ongoing shortage of pharmacy workers during the pandemic. Pharmacists previously told Insider that they were struggling to juggle the higher-than-normal workload. Yes, that is what I witness. Sometimes they're fast, efficient, and friendly, and sometimes, well, there's this whole adage about pick two, right? Yeah. I might get it fast and I don't know. I just lost my whole train of thought there. Anyway, the Wall Street Journal reported Thursday that the pharmacy chain is offering $75,000 as a sign-on bonus. Avery Hartmans is the author of this article over at businessinsider.com. That is amazing. Maybe I should become a pharmacist. No, I really like streaming, and that's what I want to do, so. If you're in my chat, say hi. I don't know if I could handle being a pharmacist. My empathy is too broad. When I'm in the room with somebody who's ill, I feel it and I want to solve the problem and I can't. Anyway, the story is Walgreens is offering up to $75,000 as a sign-on bonus for pharmacists. Let's move on to the next article. This one has been around for a while in terms of it being in the news, but not necessarily a solution. Johnson & Johnson is to stop the sale of talc-based baby powder in 2023. That's because there have been some problems with talc developing. It has been leading to, the evidence is suggesting that asbestos and ovarian cancer is developing from this talc ingredient that people use. I don't use it for anything other than casting aluminum in the mold. You dust it with talc. I might have to find something else just to completely eliminate this. I don't think I'll get ovarian cancer. But asbestos poisoning isn't really, you know, something that I'm interested in either. I don't know. It's the new millennium. It's the 21st century, so maybe I'll get ovarian cancer too. I shouldn't joke. Like I say, when I say stuff like this out loud, something's going to happen. My spleen will fall out or something. Anyway, this article is over at The Hill. Chloe Falmer is the author of this article about Johnson & Johnson stopping the sale of talc-based baby powder in 2023. I don't know. Maybe they should do it immediately, since if they have enough if they have enough rationale to do it in 2023, why not do it now? Don't worry about the sell-off. Just switch and remove it from the shelves and replace it with the solution. Because obviously you know that there is a problem with talc-based baby products in the United States and Canada. So the move comes 2 years after Johnson & Johnson announced it would stop selling its talc-based baby powder products in the U.S. and Canada amid ongoing legal battles over whether the company's baby powder and its talc ingredient led to people developing illnesses such as ovarian cancer and asbestos poisoning. I don't know. It reminds me of so many other things. Namely, you know, the nonstick coating on pans and stuff, that if it got too hot, it actually would poison the food and then you would consume it and it would poison you. And it was denied and denied and denied and denied and denied. And then they finally find in the paperwork that they knew about it and all hell breaks loose. Well, we know about it, right? If you are already at the decision where you're going to stop it, why not stop it immediately? I want to scream out, you know, like from Star Trek, don't wait for the translation. You understand what I'm saying. Okay, well, I really love makers, people who make stuff and they're passionate about it and highly skilled. And, you know, people just don't get enough attention, right? So I love the idea of this. This is over in the Bead Baby channel, and it comes from Beading Gem, which is really the main source for a lot of my maker stuff. I like the website and it has a bunch of stuff and just a ton of links all the time. So this says, watch this artisan restored a misshapen 1930s ring. And I'll just click the link and it'll send us over to Beading Gem. And that's the Beading Gem right there, Pearl Play, aka the Beading Gem. And you can watch this video. This is actually kind of an older video, but I wanted to draw some attention to this. So it is a YouTube video, so I'm not going to play it, but I want to at least, you know, you can follow the link through Ometown and go over there and watch the video and give credit where credit is due. That's pretty much all I'll say about this. Dun, dun, dun. The next article is over in the Order of the Bean channel, and it says, here are the results of Sprudge Summer 2022 Coffee Inflation Poll. I have been monitoring inflation, the CPI number in particular. I'm waiting for the next data point to drop. I suspect that it will be ever higher, but not dramatically, because inflation has been kind of suppressed because the Fed has raised core interest rates considerably. But here are the results for the Spreadsheet Summer 2022 Coffee Inflation poll. And so it says, have you experienced any price increases? And 40% of consumers said yes, 10% said no, 5% said unsure. And says professional, 43%. Now I'm curious about that. What is that 43%? So in total, 83% of all participants in the survey stated that they had noticed a price increase for coffee, but it was most evident for coffee professionals. Nearly 97% of coffee professionals polled stated that they noticed an uptick, while only 72% of consumers said the same. That's interesting. But we know that cost is increasing. Has inflation affected your coffee spending? On the professional side, 40% said, or 40.7% said yes, and consumer side, 29.6% said no, which is quite interesting. And this kind of hints at that elasticity of demand for coffee. People want their caffeine and maybe their decaffeinated coffee flavor. I know that I have been told I want my coffee, so just get out of the way and let whoever says that phrase, "I want my coffee," to get their coffee. Anyway, go over to the Sprudge. If you go to sprudge.com, you'll find this article, or you can follow the link. And I think I have one more article, which is a Disney related article. It's in the Hatch Ideas channel because it's all about business. And it is Disney edges past Netflix in streaming subscribers as it raises ad fee, raises ad-free prices. So Walt Disney edged past Netflix. It makes it sound like Walt Disney's in a race, but anyway, the company, Disney, edged past Netflix with a total of 221 million streaming subscribers at the end of the most recent quarter and announced it will launch a Disney Plus option with advertising this December. So this article's over at The Guardian, and it says Disney Plus, Hulu, and ESPN see total of 221 million customers at the end of the June quarter compared to Netflix's 220.7. Why did they link them all together, though? It made it initially sound like it was Disney Plus, but Hulu and ESPN are subsections of Disney, not necessarily tied to Disney Plus. Like, I'm a Disney Plus subscriber, but I could care less about Hulu and ESPN. So, did I get counted? Like, all of it was combined. So, how much does just Disney have? So, anyway, this is the article was constructed by Guardian staff and agencies. So, I don't know who all was involved, but it says at the end of just ended quarter, Disney Plus added 14.4 million Disney Plus customers, beating the consensus of 10 million expected by analysts polled by FactSet. Combined with Hulu and ESPN Plus, Disney said it had 221.1 million subscribers, and I really don't like that. I want to know exactly how many Disney had, nothing else. Just because it added 14 million doesn't mean it's anywhere close to Netflix. So, and the reason why I say that is that Netflix is a silo. It's a single, a unitary solution. Disney, on the other hand, is all three combined: Disney Plus, Hulu, and ESPN Plus. I don't subscribe to Hulu or ESPN Plus. So really, to me, it's only Disney Plus versus Netflix. But Disney Plus isn't really all. I'm surprised. I think Disney Plus should just roll in Hulu and ESPN, and you subscribe to one, you get all of them. But ESPN extracts additional fees. The company announced that Disney Plus with ads will cost $7.99. the same price the company now charges for the ad-free version, and the cost of the Disney Plus without will increase by $3 to $10.99 as of December 8th. So prices for Hulu, also owned by Disney, will rise by $1 to $2 a month, depending on the plan. I was afraid of actually subscribing to Hulu, even though, and the reason was I was told that you can never get Hulu without ads. If you are Disney Plus without ads right now and you try and get Hulu, it will have ads and there's no way to flip it so that it's ad free. That's what I was told, and I just figured I wouldn't mess with it. So if somebody out there knows, hey, you actually can add Hulu, I would add it for $1 or $2. It doesn't matter to me. But what I don't want is ads. I don't want ads anywhere. I'm willing to pay more for no ads. Obviously, I'm going to be paying $3 more as of December 8th. And us consumers have zero bargaining power. Why? Because the only thing we can do is leave. And they're making billions, so what does it matter that a few tens of thousands leave because they want ad-free or they don't want to pay $11 or whatever? Anyway, operating income more than doubled at the Parks, Experiences, and Products division to $3.6 billion, and they're still raising the cost. More consumers coming in, and they're raising the costs. The price, I should say, the subscription fee. Shares of Disney, which has fallen 28% this year, rose 4% in after hours, trading to $116.85. Yeah. Well, that's it for today, folks. If you are hanging out in my chat, thanks for hanging out. Really appreciate it. Tell a friend. The podcast is all up to date. YouTube is all up to date. Twitch, I would love to do show notes and all of that kind of stuff that I do over on YouTube and on the podcast, but Twitch just kind of deletes everything that I do every 14 days. So the last thing that I've every 2 weeks, the oldest thing drops off. And so it's lost forever. And you know, it just kind of bums me out because I see people actually looking at the VODs, which is really interesting. I get a lot of traffic, apparently. In the grand scheme of things, I'm a very small-time streamer. You know, I appreciate everybody that comes. But, you know, like everybody, I would love to have more people hanging out and chatting. So if you find time, follow me, subscribe, do all of that stuff so that you can be notified of when I go online. Unfortunately, due to some personal matters, I've had to push the time around here and there. At least for the next couple of weeks, that is going away. But I do have another personal matter that is pending. Anyway, that's it for today. Thanks for hanging out. Take care. Bye-bye.